the 1920s, you have presidents like Calvin Coolidge and Warren G. Harding, who certainly were anti-big government, were part of a political reaction to Woodrow Wilson's sort of failed attempts to build a worldwide system and the incredibly dispiriting losses of World War I. But in their practical actions, in their governing actions in the 1920s, there was no isolationism. There was the United States already exerting tremendous power on the world stage.
Hello, and welcome to the More Freedom Foundation podcast. I am in charge of podcasting, Marie McElhone, and in charge of politics is Robert Morris. How have you been?
Not bad, Rory, not bad. How's it going?
Yeah, things are going okay. How did your holiday go?
It was great. You know, had a good time. Went to Southeast Asia for the first time. I'm writing this book called U.S. Empire, The First 100 Years, and it made sense to go and check out some of the biggest victims of U.S. empire over the past 100 years, Cambodia and Vietnam. So it was kind of a work trip, kind of a tourism trip, but all in all, it was pretty fascinating.
How do they currently see America?
They currently love America. It's quite a shift. The Vietnam dynamic is actually somewhat similar to the Japan-Germany dynamic, where the United States was able to be very successful
with
Japan and Germany after World War II because of the threat of the Soviet Union. We're able to be very successful with Vietnam because of the threat from China. I was struck, like, being in Vietnam, just going to random tourist destinations. There's this beautiful Forbidden Kingdom-type deal, a sort of series of palaces and temples for the Vietnamese dynasty that ended up mostly being sort of collaborators with the French. But it was fascinating, and just along one very long wall, there was this extensive list of documentation from the Imperial Registry of why Vietnam owns these islands. So the Vietnamese are very, very concerned to preserve their rights against China in the South China Sea. And the United States is one of the only avenues
to
do
it. But it's called the South China Sea, so that means it's Chinese.
Sure, just like that means that Iran owns the Persian Gulf. That's how that works, right?
Exactly.
And if they successfully get enough people to call it the Arabian Gulf instead of the Persian Gulf, then everything changes because words are magic, Rory.
Yes.
Words are magic. So yeah, it was fascinating.
Anything memorable happen?
Well, I went to Thailand and decided to try some Muay Thai, which was fun. And I congratulated myself on surviving 3 days of Muay Thai training. I was very pleased with myself. Got punched in the head a little bit, which I didn't enjoy very much. And I was very pleased with myself. And then I promptly got into a motorbike accident, just one of those little scooters there. Managed to wipe out. And I've got this amazing technicolor bruise going up and down my leg and sort of scraped up my arm a fair amount. So it's all mostly... It's much better. My friends convinced me to go to the hospital a day or two later, and they just sort of, this very amused nurse was sort of picking pieces of road out of my arm, which was fun. So yeah, little scooter accident.
Has this triggered, now that you're back home in America, do you think this will trigger an isolationist phase where you'll not do much more traveling?
God, I knew you were going to do that segue, and it still bothers me. Today we're going to talk about isolationism. and just how not isolationist the United States has ever been. And I find it's certainly an accusation that's been thrown at me.
But America didn't talk to anyone until the 1930s.
Of course, Rory, that's true. Until the grand lesson of Munich, there was never at any point any kind of interaction between the United States and anybody outside. So there's this sense in U.S. political discussion that the United States has this grand tradition of isolationism, which is kind of nuts, and also that we're perpetually in danger of falling back into this tradition of isolationism and how it would be so damaging. I think that the sort of war against isolationism that we see in most foreign policy discussion seems to me, honestly, often a war against doing anything intelligent. The United States could possibly pick and choose which battles it should be involved in, could possibly make decisions and deals and choices based on its interests rather than this compulsion to be everywhere all at once. Well, it's one of the things that I find most annoying, being called an isolationist, or the extent to which isolationist is used as a slur in modern political discourse in the United States. So I thought it might be worthwhile to spend an episode talking about it.
In your idea, when do you think America was at its most isolationist?
So there are a couple periods of time in the 20th century, actually, not really before that, where you can say that there were some isolationist periods, or at least brief periods of time when isolationism, not a dominant, but a significant political current in the United States. But what's telling about those periods of time is just how incredibly brief they were. I would say a couple years in the 1930s, a couple years in the late 1970s. And that's about it, frankly. Those are periods of times when, because of dramatic U.S. policy failures, there were periods where something like the majority of the American public was against more international involvement. And that's about it. Like, this sort of grand tradition of isolationism is not something that ever really existed. In the 19th century, certainly in the first half of the 19th century, you can't talk about the United States as an isolationist power because we were a small power, incredibly dependent on trade. Like, we were, you know, the equivalent of Singapore or something like that. Okay, that overstates it. But we were tremendously dependent on agricultural exports and constantly at the mercy of European powers. Over the course of the 19th century, we became less at the mercy of European powers until, thanks to World War I, that sort of power dynamic was entirely shifted. But we were, up until World War I, we were constantly sort of being acted upon by great powers, principally the British Empire. And then after World War I, it sort of flipped and we started exerting power against every other power in the world, exerting power over every other power in the world, rather.
Well, still before World War I, you were still, you know, exerting power on Native Americans and Mexico and Cuba and the Spanish to some degree as well. Like, it wasn't just completely, you know, once World War I's over, the floodgates open.
I got a fascinating YouTube comment over the past day or so, Rory, where someone's like, there was no U.S. empire at all until 1945. Like, that's when it started. And then I'm like, all right, like, have you seen a map of the United States in 1789? Have you compared that to a map of the United States in 1900? Like, you can make an argument that actually the United States is the most successful 19th century empire because nobody even talks about it. You know, all the territory that all the European powers took that was eventually, over the course of the 1800s, was eventually stripped away from them. Even Russia, which had the closest sort of analogy to U.S. expansion because it was also continental. It wasn't like the French and the British that were taking, you know, these far-flung territories you could only sail to.
And theoretically touches two oceans.
So the United States, like, it is an empire, a continental empire that nobody even thinks about as an empire anymore. And the United States was deeply involved in negotiations, in backs and forths, in purchases to build that continental empire. You can't talk about the United States being isolationist when we were absorbing, sometimes violently, sometimes financially, a continent. We had no isolationist tradition to speak of. And it's just sort of a silly thing. Traditionally, I'm actually part of the reason why I wanted to talk about this today is because in writing this book I'm putting together, I am deep into research about the 1920s and the 1930s. And the 1920s and the 1930s are just sort of typically described as the U.S.'s most isolationist decades. And in my research, it's becoming pretty clear that this is wrong. There absolutely was an isolationist period of time in the 20s and the 30s, but it was not two decades. It honestly wasn't even one decade. It was very brief. It was, and shockingly, actually, it is during the period of one of our most internationalist, globalist presidents of all time, Franklin Delano Roosevelt, the winner of World War II, the founder of the United Nations, described him in some of my writings, may not make it into the book, as sort of the American Solon, you know, the famous Greek rule giver, or you know, the every Greek city-state had a sort of great mythical founder in the past that laid down the laws of what it was. And I think to the extent that American empire has a Solon, has a great mythical lawgiver, it's Franklin Delano Roosevelt. And what's kind of fascinating is probably the most clearly isolationist period in U.S. history in the 20th century is really during FDR's first couple years as president. Because even Herbert Hoover, who oversaw some pretty dramatically wrong-headed responses to the Great Depression, specifically a tariff that made things dramatically worse, the Smoot-Hawley tariff, was actually always, and towards the even to the end of his presidency, was looking for ways to ameliorate the worldwide depression through cooperative efforts. So he was never really an isolationist president. The 1920s, you have presidents like Calvin Coolidge and Warren G. Harding, who certainly were anti-big government, were part of a political reaction to Woodrow Wilson's sort of failed attempts to build a worldwide system and the incredibly dispiriting losses of World War I. But in their practical actions, in their governing actions in the 1920s, there was no isolationism. There was the United States already exerting tremendous power on the world stage. In fact, like some of the treaties from the 1920s, the United States fostered are, I would say, more invasive and more the opposite of isolationist than any treaty that has come since. Specifically, I'm talking about the Washington Naval Treaties, or the Washington Treaty, I think it's called. There was a Washington Naval Conference in the early 1920s. Where the United States beckoned all of the former great powers of the world, the Japanese, the French, the British, to come to Washington, D.C. and make a commitment as to what the size of their navy was going to be going forward. And this wasn't strictly the United States dictating what those numbers were going to be, but it also kind of wasn't not. Wait, how many double negatives? How many negatives are there? Like it kind of, yeah, like it was pretty much the United States telling the rest of the world how it was going to be, especially in the context of Britain and France being, you know, still owing the United States incredible amounts of money for their World War I efforts. So yeah, no, I like in the 1920s, the United States dictated to the world what size their navies could be, which is kind of crazy. This because this is a period before the United States realized, you know, the United States' political economy became so warped around arms races. The United States now, of course, wouldn't want to limit any potential rival size of military because we'd be very happy to have a rival size of military because it would give us an excuse to spend more money. But that's what the isolationist 1920s were about. There were also the Dawes and Young plans, which were basically the United States reorganizing the finances of all the traditional great powers of Europe, setting up a deal, essentially loaning money to Germany so Germany could pay that money in reparations to France and Britain, and France and Britain could use that money to pay off U.S. Banks. And so already in the 1920s,
that's incredible.
The United States was essentially the landlord of every other great power, and was telling them what size their navies could be. this idea that there was certain, and you know, it's based on some real rhetoric of presidents like Calvin Coolidge and Warren G. Harding, but it's not based on what was actually happening in politics or law. Under FDR in the 1930s, there was a real on the law, the Neutrality Acts of the 1930s. So on August 31st, 1935, Congress passed the first Neutrality Act. So that's 1935. And at that point, you can talk about a real isolationist moment in the United States in 1935.
How neutral were they? Like, were they Switzerland neutral or?
Well, so you have to have, you have the law versus FDR. And as was often the case, FDR beat the law. And I think, I'm not saying he, you know, openly broke the law, but he certainly obliterated the spirit of those laws. The intention of the Neutrality Acts of the 1930s was to keep the United States out of World War II. FDR, illegally, unconstitutionally, but 100% morally, justly, and correctly, I believe, believed that the United States had a duty to confront Nazi Germany and Japan, and used his extraordinary political resources to bring that about. So really, the isolationist moment in U.S. politics was, for a couple years in the 1930s, was very real and was very defeated by that president. Of course, the U.S.'s entry into World War II came about December 7th, 1941, as a result of the attack on Pearl Harbor. But for years prior to that, FDR had been rebuilding the U.S. military, was already heavily supporting the British in their effort to fight off Nazi Germany. You have very, very brief windows of isolationist power in U.S. politics that were usually defeated by U.S. elites.
What's the biggest isolationist myth you would like to squash?
Well, obviously the most annoying, most irritating is the comparison of absolutely everything to Munich, to the 1938 appeasement policy of Neville Chamberlain in the run-up to World War II. He was a British prime minister who famously claimed he had peace in our time, getting off a plane after a deal he did with Hitler in Munich, which Hitler very quickly violated. And, you know, it depends on who you ask.
One of history's liars.
Yeah, Hitler, not an honest dude. But it depends on who you ask. Some maintain that actually Neville Chamberlain bought valuable time for the British rearmament, gave FDR more time to
prepare,
to work his wiles and break through the legal obstacles to U.S. support for Britain. But you can also make an argument that the Czechs that Neville Chamberlain sold out were actually really greatly positioned to put up a stiff fight against the Germans that could have made it so that World War II never really happened. So, you know, who's to say? Regardless, Neville Chamberlain's actions in Munich in 1938 are, it sometimes seems like they're the only piece of history that the U.S. foreign policy establishment knows, because absolutely any question of negotiating with anybody, of possibly doing anything other than the most aggressive thing possible, is described as Munich and appeasement and this, that, and the other thing. So that'd probably be the most, described as somehow isolationist if you don't want to get involved in some conflict somewhere. So that'd probably be the most annoying isolationist myth for me, unquestionably.
Do you find a lot of people don't really consider Native American, you know, killing and expanding territory by stealing their land as, you know, not being isolationist?
Well, I don't think people really... I think people in the United States are now conscious enough of what happened there to say, gosh, sad, terrible shame. But I don't think people really consider that as a period of active conquest. I think in historical terms, I guess it happened so quickly that it's just sort of Well, we're aware of the revolution, and if we're super, super aware, we might be aware that that was actually mostly along the eastern seaboard of the United States. And then sort of hop, skip, and a jump, and we have a continental empire. And yes, we certainly did some terrible things to Native Americans, but moving on. But no, I don't think there is much of a consciousness that actually that was foreign policy. That was international relations until it wasn't. And I think that's just sort of a testament to just how successful that 19th century expansion was, that it's not even really thought of as such any longer. Yeah, I think this idea that there's this sort of thread of isolationism that must constantly be battled against is kind of ridiculous. And I think it's a very valuable tool for the militarists in U.S. society. There was this great idea of Vietnam syndrome, which was entirely rational and sensible instinct against any kind of military involvement that you could find in the U.S. public in the 1980s. And I think this is a dynamic we're getting into again and again in this episode, is that you can point towards periods of time when perhaps the majority of the U.S. public was not interested in any kind of military adventuring, but U.S. government was deep into it anyway. Supposedly we had this terrible Vietnam syndrome, and because it was actually a successful war for the first time, George H.W. Bush was sort of famously seen as defeating Vietnam syndrome in 1990, 1991, with his successful war against Saddam Hussein. He finally exorcised the ghost of Vietnam, this, that, and the other thing. But like this idea that we weren't doing military stuff is nonsense. We left Vietnam in 1973, and in the early 1980s, Ronald Reagan sent a whole bunch of Marines into Lebanon, into the midst of one of the worst war zones in the world. So it's not like there was some kind of long-standing, period of no U.S. intervention that George H.W. Bush somehow cured us
of. Chipping in the Soviet-Afghan war as well.
Yeah, exactly. So there were many, 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 many places. And I think we're debatably in a period like that right now, where, yes, the U.S. public is still very much traumatized by the experience of the first decade of this century, where George W. Bush sent a fair amount of U.S. soldiers to pointlessly die in Iraq and Afghanistan. And so people are very against the idea of U.S. involvement in a large-scale, boots-on-the-ground war. Yet in Ukraine, in Libya, in Syria, we've had tremendous effects, I would argue have been the largest actor in bringing about quite ruinous conflict, and are working really, really, really hard to do the same thing in Taiwan. Yet some would probably describe this. Actually, I think, figures like Robert Kagan, who we've talked about, describe this era as tremendously isolationist, because there is real public resistance to U.S. soldiers going to places and fighting. I do think that there is a strong enough resistance to that if Israel is successful in starting the war with Iran that they want to, we would certainly do a lot of bombing on Israel's behalf, but there's no question of boots on the ground attempting to invade Iran. U.S. boots, I don't see that as possible in this era of U.S. history. But the idea that we're somehow isolationist now is nuts. Nuts. We are running, rather large-scale wars in the Middle East and Europe right now, simultaneously. And a lot of people in Washington, D.C. See fit to complain about how isolationist our era is right now, which is just gets my goat, Rory.
What benefits can you see from if America was to be properly isolationist?
Oh, I don't think there are any benefits. By isolationist, and the way that it's often described is something like autarky, we're going to be completely self-sufficient. And I think there are people who have fantasies of that. I think there's no question that the United States is probably the country on the planet that is most capable of some kind of autarky of cutting ourselves off from trade or that, this, that, and the other thing. But I don't see why we would.
Becoming a big North Korea?
Yeah, I don't see why we would. And that there are elements of Trump's approach to things that do seem to be like truly lusting after autarky, and we're going to make everything here and this, that, and the other thing. Which is not to say that there isn't scope for higher tariffs or being a little more industrial policy friendly, doing work to make sure that we do make some more things here, more strategic about the way that we allot our supply lines. That I mean, that of course, but like a full on truly isolationist autarkic approach is kind of pointless. And also, if you're concerned about American power, if you think American power is something worth continuing, are continuing sort of trade imbalances and allowing people to sell as much stuff here as they do are vastly more important than, say, our relationship with Israel or Ukraine or even Taiwan. We have never been an isolationist country in terms of trade, and we should never be so. It's just not in our nature, and it's not conducive to U.S. power. So, no, I can't. I mean, it's interesting because, like, I think part of the reason why I find the accusation of isolationists so irritating is that if we were actually to ever apply, like, real isolationist ideas, I would be dramatically opposed to that. So I get irritated when I'm like, maybe we should murder fewer people. And people are like, isolationist? I'm like, what? You know, like, maybe we should do fewer wars. Like, why do you want to live in North Korea? I'm like, huh? Like, it's quite insane. I mean, and in fact, a lot of the military action that it's claimed to be isolationist to oppose actually endangers the real sources of U.S. power and U.S. trade, the U.S. economic integration of the world, that kind of thing.
Ideally, where would you see things? Obviously, as you say, you want less wars, which gets you called an isolationist. But then obviously you don't want to just, you know, brick off the border and no one's allowed in or out, something like that.
No.
Where would you like the lines to be?
I love diplomacy. I want more of that. I think that we absolutely need a fully funded State Department. We need more thought and more strategy behind a lot of policies that the United States undertakes. I think the isolationist accusation is used against people who think we should do a little less than everything, you know? And I think that I definitely want to do less than everything, but in diplomatic terms, I want to do more. Like, I want to see the U.S. more present in the world. Like, you know, if we hadn't spent the $6 trillion on Iraq and Afghanistan, yeah, I would have preferred to see like $5 trillion of that being spent on, oh, I don't know, healthcare and science. But I'd have been content to see $1 trillion of that being spent on public diplomacy, on getting U.S. narratives out there, thinking a little bit harder about what U.S. narratives should be, facilitating U.S. economic penetration elsewhere. I am not against U.S. empire, Rory. I am against stupid U.S. empire.
Is there a country you currently see, or maybe historically, where you feel like they had a nice balance that could be a good model for America?
Oh, wow. Well, you know, I'm very suspicious of models going back before the Industrial Revolution. Like, I don't believe that's really doable, because things are just so much more different now. I mean, I wonder, like, are there eras of the British Empire where I think they sort of got it right? Before the first decade of the 20th century, the British Empire experienced something that I think the United States would be more than capable of. And yes, they did use the term. I think they called it splendid isolation. And it was not isolation from trade, obviously. It was is not isolation from involvement in the world, obviously, as the British Empire continued to metastasize on every continent. But what it was not getting tied down in treaty organizations with other great powers or what have you. Really, within a decade of Britain getting involved in things like the Triple Entente with France and Russia. I think Britain was always very suspicious about putting any of this stuff into writing or making very firm treaty commitments. But in the first decade of the 20th century, they got much more interested in sort of setting up more formal, more sustained relationships with other European powers, and their empire didn't survive more than 15 years of that crap. The United States is infinitely more powerful than the British Empire was, so we've been able to survive with NATO commitments for most of a century at this point. But I think the model, something it would be nice to get back to, is a sort of splendid isolation of the sort that Britain maintained, where friendly with everybody, trading with everybody, not making treaty commitments to anybody. Treaty commitments, so that could be interpreted incredibly broadly. I think that the trade treaties, all manner of, participation in international organizations and multilateral institutions, that's great. But these sort of security-related defense commitments, military commitments, are something that I believe the United States has no use for. To be clear, I'm not for abandoning NATO now. I'm for abandoning NATO in the 1990s and the 2000s, which we absolutely should have done. If we had done that, I don't believe there'd be a war in Ukraine now. But now that there is a war in Ukraine that we fostered and created, and the Ukrainians rely upon us to help them with, I don't think we should abandon that now. Exactly the same level of commitment to international and trade organizations that we have now, perhaps significantly higher, but dramatically fewer military commitments would be my sort of ideal picture. And I think you can kind of look at some eras of the British Empire and see that.
Do you feel the EU's getting it right? They're not getting too tangled up in other people's wars, but generally other countries are happy to see them because they generally bring a prosperous trade deals.
To some extent, really, like everybody other than the United States is getting it right. I think China is sensible in that it's not really committed to any kind of serious agreement with anybody else. I mean, sure, there's the Collective Security Treaty Organization, the CSTO, or there's a Shanghai Cooperation, or I guess the CSTO is more Russia, right? But then there's the Shanghai Cooperation Organization. There's all manner of sort of like low stakes.
Yeah, but Russia's very happy to dump it when it's convenient.
Yes, which they should, frankly. Like, I think that people always see it as some kind of like conversation ending when I'm complaining about NATO expansion. So it's kind of like conversation ending point where they're like, well, Eastern Europe wanted this. Eastern Europe wanted these NATO commitments. Like, how can you possibly be against that? It's like, okay, what do I get out of it? What does the United States get out of all these commitments we've made to Eastern Europe that antagonize and have destroyed our arms limitation agreement with the only other nuclear power currently capable of obliterating human civilization? What does humanity get out of that? Like, I am fully cognizant and aware of what Latvia and Lithuania and Estonia think they're getting out of NATO membership, might even agree with what they're getting. They think they're getting out of NATO membership. How exactly does humanity or the United States benefit in any way other than making the annihilation of human civilization more likely? So, yeah, I think I'm making quite clear that I am not a big fan of military commitments and treaty organizations. There's this great line, I think, in perhaps George Washington's farewell address is overly used. He famously, after finishing his two terms as president, he made a striking call for unity in the United States, North and South, East and West, this, that, and the other thing, and also said, beware of foreign entanglements. Don't get involved in foreign affairs. And I do think that's honestly a little oversold as like this lesson that's always going to apply to the United States by people who are generally on my side, who are more anti-intervention, because again, I mean, George Washington, this was, I guess this would have been 1799 or 1790, anyway, the 1790s, late 1790s, making this farewell address to a country that was like a handful of cities clinging to the eastern seaboard. So what makes sense for, don't get involved, don't sign anything as this weak guy running around the ankles of all these European powers, I don't think it necessarily applies to the modern United States, which is the most powerful country in human history. So I think that can be oversold a bit, but man, there's some great lines in there. The one that really stuck with me this morning was, "The nation which indulges towards another a habitual hatred or a habitual fondness is in some degree a slave." And of course, George Washington was a slave owner, and that's very bad and it should be acknowledged. But just simply pointing out that it's unwise for any state to have perpetual enemies or perpetual friends. And you sort of look, and I think that's very true, and you look at the way that the United States has organized itself since the end of World War II, or especially since the end of the Cold War, and it's all habitual fondness and habitual hatred, to the point where countries desperately, desperately warp themselves into all kinds of positions to be our friends, and we continue hating them regardless because it's important to our defense budgets to continue hating them. The great tragedy of Russia is that before Vladimir Putin and under Vladimir Putin, very, very interested in doing anything to make us happy, and then just coming to this reluctant realization that there was no world where the United States would be happy with a Russia that retained anything like medium power status. I think China's had that same realization. I think Iran has been trying desperately since the 1990s to get back into our good graces. And we're like, nope, sorry, you did something bad to us 45 years ago. We've got to hate you forever because otherwise it's going to be real hard to justify these defense budgets. So it's all habitual hatred. And if you try to speak out against any of that habitual hatred, well, you're an isolationist.
How much military withdrawal would you, you know, consider? You talked about how you'd like to split up NATO. Would you give up places like Ramstein in Germany and Pine Gap in Australia? Like, what would your ideal military withdrawal from the world look like?
That's a great question, Rory. It's funny because when I was younger and more fire-breathing, I would have been like, oh, give it all up. We don't want any of it. But you know, I'm less of that now, largely because of the problems we've created. Like, the reality is that we created a rogue Russia. We're trying as hard as we can to create a rogue China, and those exist now. Yeah, if we had pulled out of Ramstein, if we had disbanded NATO in the 1990s and the 2000s, Russia would not be a problem. Certainly not for us. And I don't really think Russia would have been a problem for the Ukrainians. I think, you know, Russia would probably be working its way through the Acquise Communautaire right now and probably failing to become an EU member. But instead, we kept things at a high pitch of militarization. And the tragedy of it is that now that we've created this problem, you know, I don't advocate getting rid of NATO at this point. I think that the first step that I think is absolutely invaluable would be to pull out of the Middle East. I see no value to our troop presence in the Middle East. And vitally, we can operate any kind of Middle East power projection that we could possibly need from Diego Garcia on one side and from Ramstein on the other side. It's completely unnecessary for us to be there, our troop presence there.
Would it be a quick withdrawal like Afghanistan, or would you like to have it planned to try to make it as peaceful as possible?
Well, I don't think I find it hard. I don't think if we pulled out of Ramstein, we'd have Germans hanging off the plane. Yeah, that's the plane flew.
Oh,
landed.
Yes. But if you completely abandoned Israel, for instance, I can see that suddenly causing an immediate situation.
We'll never abandon Israel. That's the thing. Like, that's not going to happen. But we don't need thousands of troops sort of sitting there as missile targets for Iran and their proxies in Iraq and Syria. We don't need 10,000 U.S. troops sitting around in Qatar. You know, what those troops do in Iraq and Syria, specifically, they sit there waiting to be hit by Iran or Iran proxies to give Washington, D.C. that war that they desperately want. And what our troops do in Bahrain and Qatar and the UAE is they help to shore up a bunch of really gross Gulf monarchies. I don't think if we pulled out all our troops out of all those places tomorrow, the Iraqi or Syrian or Gulf monarchies would instantly fall. It's entirely plausible that actually the region would get much more peaceful much more quickly. And I think that is so. As far as like the kinds of instant military withdrawals I would like to see is just almost everything in the Middle East. We've got 50,000 troops there that don't need to be there. Cost is tens of billions of dollars every year. Are mostly just a starting ticket. Pull out of there entirely. And I think what's interesting is that when there were minor pullbacks of U.S. troops in the 1990s, and that yielded some of the most peace-loving and friendly eras in Chinese and Russian government. Us leaving led to us backing down a little bit, led to a much more peaceful world. And I think if we were to simply pull all of our people out of the Middle East, and pull everybody out of North Africa, though all the coup juntas that we trained seem to be doing that for us and kicking us out, which is nice. But if we just pulled out of North Africa and the Middle East entirely, I think you could possibly see peace dividends flow from that, more stability in those regions, leading to more people being interested in negotiation with the United States. The fact that the United States seems to just go places, stay there forever, double down in the face of the governments that are hosting us, asking us to leave, that's not a good dynamic for long-term peace. That's, in fact, a good dynamic to breed resistance. That would be a military posture I'd be happier with.
Has the country ever been completely the opposite of isolationist more than America currently is? It just feels like America's just everywhere indefinitely.
Well, I mean, we're everywhere indefinitely, but we are more self-sufficient than most other countries. I think that the percentage of our GDP that's dependent on international trade is much lower than anybody else's. So really, I mean, I guess on some levels, we're not that open on some levels. Have I just contradicted myself for the whole episode? I hope not. But as far as countries being more open, absolutely. If you look at, honestly, the economic models, I'm not too familiar with this at the moment, but the economic models of most of the Asian tigers are incredibly dependent on trade and openness. I mean, think of places like Singapore, that are unimaginable without openness to broader places. China is much more open than the United States is, open to and dependent on trade. Of course, China, I think this is true, that China has been more savvy about making decisions about which actors they should let in, which actors, you know, what they should allow the actors they do let in to do. And I think there's much more of a scope for that for the United States. But I would say really every country in the world, Rory, is more trade dependent and internationalist in its orientation than the United States is, which is interesting because the United States is still, you know, in charge. Well, and in charge just on the basis of the small fraction of U.S. trade, U.S. Investment that makes it out of the country, which is... I think kind of fascinating.
Can you realistically see America becoming more isolationist in the next decade?
Depends on how you measure it. I think that there's no question that over the past decade, we've become less interested in new trade agreements. That is something that we're probably not going to see until the 2030s.
Because I think you were maybe saying in previous episodes, it might be good for America to sort of look at the trade deals it has currently and kind of figure out what's best instead of just, you know, blindly going for more, more, more.
Yeah, and it's not just the United States. I think it would be good for all countries to engage in a bit of reflection on how much sovereignty are we interested in giving up to the United States, frankly, or to like international corporations. But I don't really see that as like a full stop or like really a trend towards isolationism, because there's the baselines that these agreements have already have set you know, need to be developed from. Like, we don't know what comes next. Like, it's not like it is not a, I think we've talked, I don't know if it was this episode or the last, no, we've talked a fair amount on this episode about, you know, just the conflict between what the law is, what the treaty is, and what the practice is, and how FDR, you know, despite having the most isolationist legislative environment of anybody, ended up being our most internationalist president. So, like, just, yeah, things just need more time to shake out. But certainly many people who are advocates of greater free trade agreements would say, like, oh, it's a terrible new isolationist era. I think if Donald Trump becomes president, he's an incredibly ineffectual mess, and it will continue to be an ineffectual mess. I do think that he will have more people around him and in his cabinet that are will potentially be more effective at carrying out some of the somewhat suicidally anti-global policies that he advocates. I think probably we should have started at the outset. The most flagrantly anti-isolationist aspect of the United States is the fact that we are a nation of immigrants. We at no point, even between 1923 and 1964, when we had pretty restrictive immigration laws, even during that period, we were welcoming in tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands of people every year. And during most of U.S. history, it's been dramatically more than that. Migration into the United States is our greatest strength. It's, I would argue, one of the bedrock, the core of our identity. And if a new Trump administration is successful in breaking that immigration engine to a higher extent than they were last time, then yeah, that seems like real isolationism and a real bad thing that could happen.
Are you under the assumption that Trump's going to win?
No, I'm not there yet. No, I still think Biden's most likely to win.
Okay.
Especially if, as we discussed in our last episode, if we really are at an inflection point where Biden is finally going to be like, all right, knock it off to Israel. I think if we've got, what, another 6 months until the election?
Well, it seems likely once whoever wins the election that Israel will reduce its mass murder.
Oh, it's possible. I think we've talked about that possibility, but I don't think we should make any assumptions. It remains tremendously fraught. I guess it'll be a couple of weeks in the past now by the time this is uploaded, but Israel blew up an Iranian embassy. That's a tremendous escalation.
They're doing their best to get America like totally involved in a war with Iran, but it seems like Iran's just not taking the bait.
Yeah, Iran would really rather not. As we have been multiple times over the past 5 years, we are incredibly reliant on heroic levels of restraint from the Iranian government, which is depressing. Not where I'd like to be, but as where we are. So,
are there any big policies that Biden's hinted at that you are looking forward to that might make America a bit more isolated, but in a way that may be good for America or the globe?
I think that Biden's emphasis on industrial policy is a good thing, and is certainly a step away from free trade orthodoxy of the past.
So bringing more jobs that were traditionally in China back to America?
Yeah, and increasing sort of supply chain resilience. I think those are the kinds of intelligent choices that Donald Trump talked a lot about making and never made any. But I think Biden has been doing a fair amount of that. And not to say that all of it has been wise. I think his attacks on the Chinese tech industry have been really poorly thought out and pretty unsuccessful. I think that there are definitely aspects of some of his infrastructure spending, some of his environmental spending that may be unwise or could be done better. But I think in general, it is a positive trajectory. And frankly, like the building up of more U.S. infrastructure, more U.S. manufacturing capacity, I think would probably tend to yield in a decade or two a renewed commitment on the part of the United States to worldwide economic integration. Because if you've got more manufacturing, that means you've got more stuff to sell. So would be my thinking. But yeah, I just generally wanted to talk about this whole myth of U.S. isolationism, which is just not a thing that's ever really existed, right? To just sort of accuse anybody who wants us to do fewer stupid things of being some kind of rabid enemy of international activity is nuts, in my opinion. So just want to put that out there.
All right. Well, thank you very much for listening, and we will catch you next time.
Huzzah.
The More Freedom Foundation is also available on YouTube and TikTok. Rob's Twitter is Rob O'Law, and he's also written a book called Avoiding the British Empire, What It Was and How the US Can Do Better. And music provided by Kevin MacLeod.